Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. And we have decided to take on a very, very interesting topic today, a topic that has absorbed us for several days now, and I'm sure it will be very interesting, and I'm sure that it will bring up facets and aspects that have bothered us, thrilled us, excited us, depressed us at different points of time in our own life. And the theme is the enigma called the mind. Mind is a never-ending kind of topic, and Swami has extensively dealt with it. That's our great good fortune, and we just thought that it would be a great sadhana for ourselves to go into this theme, and also a refreshing satsang in order to, when we discuss this with our global audience. So that will be the theme, and as always, there is Brother Prem joining me. Along with Prem, we have a special guest, Brother Amay. He'll also be joining us in this satsang when we discuss this enigma called the mind. But before we begin and go on this exciting journey, as always, we offer our most humble and grateful pranams to at the lotus feet of our beloved Master and Swami, who is seated here in the studio guiding our every thought, our word and our action. With that, we begin. Sairam Prem, Sairam Amay.
Sairam, Sairam Amay.
Sairam, Sairam Prem and Anand.
I think your services today will be much appreciated given the complexity of the topic that we are handling.
I think any number of people joining in today, you know, are going to complicate it and simplify it.
Absolutely. I mean, if there's any one singular topic which has interested mankind over a long period of time, I think it's mind. And depending on which phase they were in, you know, clearly, at least in psychology, they say you can clearly demarcate the different phases in psychological study. And there would be one personality who kind of ruled that era, and everybody else would find out things which would support the views of that person. You know, it happens in science, it happens in psychology too. So invariably that way, but you know, if you look at Vedanta and Vedas, the study of mind has been eternal. From the time when man could study anything, I think he started studying the mind.
So I think in many ways, science itself has grappled with this topic. Is mind a science or is it an art? I think for a long time it was in the domain of philosophy, in the domain of art, in the domain of some kind of an abstract, and the scientists would refuse to acknowledge the presence of mind, because for them matter always held sway for a long time. And even while we were trying to figure out what matter is, you know, and Bhagwan very beautifully used to say, you know, don't mind and doesn't matter. But I think now science, in the last probably 200-250 years, a lot of study has gone into the concept of mind, discovery of mind, and to know that I think with quantum mechanics, to a certain extent, maybe a very rudimentary, I'm not a expert on this field, but just to know that even science and physics to a large extent is beginning to understand the role that a mind plays in experiment, right? So the scientists, and so now probably psychiatry and psychology have slowly started moving or have got the status of science. So probably it is a science as well as an art.
As you rightly said, you know, this would always happen, and Swami would say, you would either be focused so much on the soft and the, the right brain kind of aspects of the mind, or else you would be totally in the statistics figures like the scientists, and therefore, for the scientists, the mind, it didn't matter, and for the people who were fully into this kind of study of the right brain study of the mind, you know, matter, they wouldn't mind about it, because as Swami would often say. But this mind, as I said, holds special significance for us devotees because of Bhagwan, I mean, because the first ever message that Swami gave us had as its first ever word the word mind. Swami began by saying Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam, where he said, O mind, meditate on the feet of the Lord. You know, and I'm just reminded of one personal incident with this regard. Swami says, Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam, O mind, meditate on the feet of the Lord. It almost is like a command to humanity to offer the mind only at the lotus feet of the Lord and nowhere else. And when I personally tried to do something of this to this effect, I had a surprising reply. I remember it was those days when Swami would give darshan in the red Maruti Esteem car. He would be seated in the passenger seat in the front. One day when he was coming, we were all thrilled because the window was open. And as Swami came close, I happened to be in the first line, so I got up and, there were a lot of things bothering me. Mm-hmm. I tried to summarize the whole thing and I just told Swami, my mind is troubling me a lot. Please control my mind. And I thought this was the greatest kind of prayer or offering I can do. Here I was offering my mind to my master, just as he had commanded way back in 1940, saying, Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam. But Swami's reply was, your mind and you're asking me to control? No, I can't do it. This is what Swami said, and I was really taken aback with this reply. But since the car had actually stopped and it was a golden opportunity I was getting to converse, I didn't want the conversation to end in that manner. So I said, okay Swami, I will control it, but please you have to give me the strength to control it. I thought I wanted Swami to take onus or responsibility of something at least. And me failing to control my mind is not just my weakness, it's also a lack of participation on his part. So when I told him that, Swami, I will do it, but you give me the strength to do it, Swami's response again was, the strength I have already given. I mean, the strength is already there, it's up to you to do it. So with that, the car moved on and I sat back. Today when I look back at it, I just feel, all its incidents like these, thoughts like these that make the mind an even bigger mystery. On one hand, Swami, you're telling, let your mind be, offer your mind to the Lord, because only the Lord is worthy enough of receiving this offering called the mind. And when you try to do that kind of offering in the way you understand, Swami says, no, you have to, it's all your own prerogative. So definitely it is something that baffles not just the scientists, but even spiritual sadhaks and spiritual aspirants alike.
Absolutely. I am reminded of another very beautiful experience that I heard. This happened way back in the 1970s when summer courses would go on with, students coming from all over the country. And so it was one fine evening when Swami had spoken about himself and how he has complete control over senses and the need for controlling senses. The beauty with Swami is, and in fact the mind plays such a huge role when you are with Bhagwan. When you are directly in his presence, in his direct divine presence, it just stops functioning. Or it just starts functioning in the most weird and, horrible way. You start doubting, you start thinking, does he know this? Should I put it this way, etc. So there was one such student or very close devotee of Bhagwan who had spent many years at his lotus feet, was in his direct duty in the old bungalow in Vrindavan. And next day morning, Swami had asked for a cup of coffee. And this brother took a little while to actually get the coffee, and Swami, he felt that Swami was very agitated, and Swami kind of reprimanded him for taking so long to bring the coffee. And in his mind, he started thinking, just yesterday this Swami tells that he has control over his senses. He can't wait for 10 minutes for a cup of coffee. Mm. Is his so agitated? What kind of a control does he have? And then, especially when you get these kind of thoughts, it just starts spiraling. And so, what Swami does? He actually adds fuel to that fire, by making you go further into that rabbit hole. Of course, Swami knew that thought. A few minutes later, Swami picked up a handful of groundnuts, and he stepped out of the golden, the old bungalow, and he just stood out over there. And as we all know, there were so many trees around Vrindavan, infested almost with monkeys.
Mm-hmm. I think Brother Ramai will know very well because he did the monkey boy duty there.
Oh yes, yeah. We became monkeys rather.
Chasing the monkeys.
Yes. So, of course, eventually when I started doing it, the number of monkeys had reduced a lot. But yeah, there were lots of monkeys. Swami just opened his palm and he called all the monkeys. And it is said, the people who were there saw the most beautiful of sights, which is all these wild monkeys standing in a line, walking up to Bhagwan and taking one peanut each from Swami's hand.
One.
All of them got prasadam, okay? And so by then, you know, sizable, all those who were in Vrindavan, you know, were kind of looking over Swami, seeing this spectacular sight. The whole thing got over. So even while this itself was spectacular in its own way, what Swami said after this was the real clincher. After all this entire exercise happened, Swami simply turned back and looked at this particular brother who had had this thought that, oh Swami, you know, Swami just looks at him and says, I can control these monkeys, but I can't control your monkey mind. You know, and that is probably the power that our mind has. I still remember just one more incident where Swami was speaking to a bunch of foreigners in the interview room, and Swami said, Sai Baba has the power to convert heaven into earth and earth into heaven, but I cannot transform your mind towards God. That will be your self-effort. That is your duty. That is your sadhana.
I mean, it's beautiful, and just going by whatever you were sharing, and I'm reminded of another beautiful thing which happened when we were studying. This was written that, you know, we used to have this conversation that Swami used to have in the portico would be made into a book.
Right? Das Pek Sai.
Das Pek Sai, beautiful book. During that time when that lion dance was the star item during one of the sports meets.
2001.
Swami used to call those boys regularly. This was something which happened in the interview room, which they included in this book. A very beautiful incident where these boys were around Swami, and Swami was talking to them something, and suddenly Swami waved his hand and materialized this huge diamond. Okay, very, very large diamond, sparkling. And the boy said, Swami, is that the Kohinoor? Swami said, Chi, this is more valuable than that. It's a bigger than diamond, bigger than that. And you know, whenever Swami materialized the diamond, you could see that glitter on the object as well as on Swami. Like, no, Swami said, see how it's shining, see how it's shining. Thousands of faces, and Swami was looking around. And one of the boys there, you know, really became very creative, and he looked at Swami and said, Swami, can you make our lives also shine like this? Okay. Swami said, of course. You give me your life, I'll make it shine. Okay. Very beautifully Swami said that. And then Swami asked them, what do I say when I talk of a diamond? Then everybody said, Swami, diamond. Swami says, diamond is diamond. Okay. Swami said, yes. Diamond is not important. Diamond is important, Swami said. So immediately another boy quipped. He said, Swami, you should kill our minds. Swami said, tapagunda. You give me the mind, I will kill it for you. Swami said, you know how beautiful it is, you know, going back to Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam, and going back to this thing of Swami saying that I cannot do anything to your mind. Probably that choice of giving our mind to Him is still there. We will go into what it really means to give our mind to Swami sometime later. But Swami is giving us the assurance that I will do my part if you do your part of choosing to give your mind to me. And I think that is where the encouragement is. And probably that's where it stops, because where Swami says, I can control a monkey, but I can't control your monkey mind.
I'm reminded, in fact, of another, if you all recollect, we were all there, I think in the last but one Sai Sannidhi day in the year 2009, Swami walked in, he came in into the bhajan hall, and we were all sitting, we had sung a couple of songs, and after the songs there was pin drop silence, and then Swami says the usual question.
Any questions?
Aim samacharam, any questions? And there was no question, you know, coming. And then Swami said, if you don't have any questions, why have you called me? And then he looked at a couple of elders and said, see, they don't have any questions. So I remember at that time, you know, I just wanted Swami to sit there and start some kind of conversation. So I had asked this question, Swami, how to control the mind? And I remember that what ensued for the next 1.5 hours was probably the most beautiful one-to-one discourses that Swami gave on mind itself. And he started with, you remember, Arvind, with that beautiful example of the dog.
Right.
In the mirror,
hall of mirrors.
In the hall of mirrors, which in itself is a very fascinating topic, and you know, is a fascinating example to give when we are probably explaining something like Mano Moolam Idam Jagat.
Right.
Every dog thinks that there are 100 other dogs, so which is nothing but a projection of his own reflection. You know,
but even this thing of, you know, asking Swami how to control the mind, the responses have been so varied.
Correct.
I mean, varied in a profound sense. But even in the sense that Swami has sometimes got irritated. I remember one of the old students sharing that in their interview or their bhajan hall session, then Swami asked, do you have any questions? And promptly this question came up, Swami, how to control the mind? And Swami actually became very angry. He said, all my discourses are about that. I keep telling it all the time. You are not ready to implement it and follow it. You keep coming back to me and asking me about it. So he said, I've given it. I mean, whatever needs to be done has already been told to you.
Yeah, I guess because he knows, you know. Swami would often say, right, it's not just a mad monkey mind.
Right. It is not just a monkey, but it's a mad monkey
mind. It's not just a mad monkey mind. It's a drunken mad monkey mind, which is then bitten by a scorpion.
Keep trying to add things to make it, to try to make you understand how terrible it is. As an aside, I also remember, Ravi Kumar sir from Vrindavan. Mm-hmm. He would often say, when a student would try to lie and try to outwit the teacher, mm-hmm. So he would say, "What do you think? Is my IQ so low like that?" Of a snail would be a good thing to say, because a snail is a very slow and sluggish creature. But he would say, "Do you think that my IQ is so low like that of a mentally handicapped snail?" I laughed when he used the analogy first time because I understood he's trying to just highlight the handicap or the low IQ. In the same way, monkey is good enough, but Swami would say a mad monkey, a drunken mad monkey, bitten by a scorpion, because...
I think, because he... I guess one of the greatest creations of the Lord was not only the human being, but the human being being endowed with this faculty called mind. And then probably, I think he is now wondering, why did I create it? Because the way Swami would say it, every time he tried to describe the mind, the way he would, drunken, mad, monkey mind, imagine the power and how erratic it can be, how all over the place it can be.
I see the importance of, Swami is repeating that, it's just not just a mad monkey, it's a drunken mad monkey. We do realize that it's difficult to control the mind. Probably we don't realize how really difficult it is to control the mind, because that's why Swami was saying, because many times, there's another beautiful discourse, of course this is not about the mind, Swami is talking about meditation. And then Swami was telling that what is meditation, and it's different from contemplation, and what Swami usually says, concentration, contemplation, meditation. And then Swami says, there are sages in the Himalayas who've given up everything, who've been sitting there for years and years trying to master this art of meditation. Do you think you can sit for 10 minutes, 20 minutes every morning and master this art? Okay? It is not meditation. What you're doing is not meditation. Because he's saying that only if you acknowledge how difficult it is, you will really back it up with that much effort. And I think that's why Swami was emphasizing when he talks about the mind, it's not ordinary. I know that you're finding it difficult, but it's much more difficult than it actually appears, so that you will be all the more vigilant in dealing with it.
In fact, whenever we start thinking of this theme, even before the satsang, when we thought what we should be discussing, it started off by, let's talk about controlling the mind. But as we go through the different things Swami has said in different discourses and just collect them, you see that you're left with a mountain pile, wondering whether mind is a hero, whether mind is a villain, whether mind is a positive thing, whether it's a negative thing. One thing definitely becomes clear, that it is something that separates humans from animals.
Right.
Because many times modern science, with the advances in neurobiology and neurology and the connection of neurons, it is almost looking like everything that we associate with the mind is actually a chemical reaction in the brain or something like that. But still, there are fascinating aspects, because if this is all the property of the brain, how come that one brain does it, the other brain does not do it? A reptilian brain, a mammalian brain versus a human brain. There are definitely some things very, very unique about the human brain, but even all that uniqueness is not able to explain some things. For example, like we were discussing the other day, how is it that twins, identical twins, brought up in the same condition, brought up in the same home, end up being such diverse personalities years down the line? It's so fascinating, so amazing. Because even if you leave out twins, actually if you see, when we begin our journey as beings, when we begin as that zygote, as a single-celled zygote in the womb of our mother, the similarities are so striking. In fact, you can't distinguish one zygote from the other. Even up to 3 months, you can't differentiate between the fetuses. But you see, within the span of 9 months, 10 months, it leads to so much of difference, and once the baby is born, possibly there are a lot of similarities, but as the baby grows a little older, you see so much of differences coming in. And you bring that down to genetics. You say it's genetics that did it. There is definitely something as deep and profound, if not more deep and profound, of genetics at a higher level, because we see that even when genetics is same, as it happens in identical twins, there is a vast difference in personalities. So there is some kind of a genetics of personality, which I think is related to the mind, which even to this day, modern science with all its advances can't explain.
Exactly. I mean, completely agree with you. I think these are just semantics, you know, what we are now attributing everything to the gene or to the DNA. For example, today the scientists are saying that every thought that you have had leaves an imprint on the DNA, and that is why the collective DNA of all human species is becoming more and more intelligent. Mm-hmm. And that is how evolution, the whole process of evolution actually takes place. That why is, we often say, right, are aajkal ke ladke means, you know, today's generation is so smart, mm-hmm. and then that generation will say, you know, our parents said that about us. It's actually because we are all the collective, you know, we are the product of the collective wisdom of the thousands of generations of human beings. Okay, and so, and how is that? It's through thought, word and action. So that is actually leaving an imprint on the DNA. And so whether you call it genetics or vasanas, the way our scriptures would mention it, I think they are just semantics which actually are describing the same thing. You know, whether, you know, maybe I can just add in over here a completely flip this thing. I remember when I see Brother Arvind, I remember Swami would often, you know, he would be jumping around, you know, Bhagwan, and then Swami said, I'll send you to mental hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember he telling that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was another thought which came, how something, you know, when something goes wrong with the mind, right, for when something goes wrong with the body, you just, you know, you put some medicine to it and you just put it together. If your bone breaks, you know, it's very easy to do that. But when something goes wrong with your mind, then the whole treatment of that is, it goes to another level, right? Most of the times, the doctors are figuring out what is the problem. Mm. You know, is it, so now we have 100 different types of mental diseases, and in fact, these are becoming more and more prevalent, more and more widespread. We see these kind of mind diseases not sparing. I mean, this has got nothing to do with how your lifestyle has been. Sarvepalli Radhakrishna, the first president of India, right, he had dementia and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Right, probably one of the greatest philosophers of modern India. We see lots of great philosophers who have thought and done so much during their life. Suddenly they are down. You know, they have some mental disease, schizophrenia, you know, bipolar. There's so many things associated, and science is just not able to deal. They are only able to deal with the pharmacological aspects of it, meaning
pharmacological.
Meaning how to address the symptoms.
Control. Huh?
Yeah. If somebody is not sleeping, give some medicine, make him sleep. If somebody is not, you know, is going bizarre in his mind, give some medicine, calm the mind. Right, calm the brain or the thoughts in the brain. But what exactly is the cause of it? Why did it happen? Why in this person? Why not in this person? Right, this is, and all of this is still, in the words of Mandukya Upanishad, still at the waking stage. We have not even begun to try and understand what is this dream world, which are the set of hormones which are getting released, which creates an entirely beautiful or nightmarish dream world. Right, so we are still only kind
in
of
the
grappling.
Waking mind.
Yeah, in the waking mind. Mm-hmm. So there is a waking mind, there's the dream mind.
Going back to what you were saying about how the mind differentiates the animal life from the human life, there's a beautiful TED talk, a neuroscientist, he explains. I mean, in what happens actually in the human evolution against what was happening in the animal evolution. He gives the example of the polar bears, right? Hmm. The polar bears, he says, you know, probably they were tropic animals. Then they started migrating towards the north and they go towards the colder climates. Then he says the skin starts becoming thick because of the fat accumulation under the skin. The brown fur becomes white slowly to help in camouflaging. Then it starts becoming more fluffy and thicker to help in this one. And he says, do you know, all of this happens over a few million years, right? Because this is the memory of the gene, as you were saying, the memory of the gene starts collecting, I need to change this about the physical attribute. He says, this has happened over a million years, and what has happened much, much later, a human species develops, and a few of them migrate towards the north. What do? They catch the polar bear, they remove the skin, and they wear it over themselves, and they are living in the same conditions. Right? They have not waited till the evolution does what the evolution did to the polar bear. And he said that is because the evolution is happening in the mind. You know, what you were telling about the intelligence is becoming more and more advanced as the generations go. The evolution has shifted to a completely different level when it comes to the human being. But the best part is, Swami, who speaks about all these things, he'll say, you've gone to the moon, you've done this, you've done that. Swami says, all of this is minuscule compared to what the human mind can achieve. I mean, that actually opens up a completely different perspective about the human mind. We think we've achieved so much. Swami is saying that, I mean, it's absolutely nothing. And of course, Swami will quote examples of Hiranyakashipu and things. I mean, and correct, they were
the
like
scientists
are much more greater.
Gone to the sun.
Literally challenging us by saying that, you know, what you have explored is absolutely infinitesimal compared to what
I mean, and just to kind of probably sum up this part, I mean, we are still in the various koshas. We probably spend a lot of our time as human species in the Annamaya kosha, trying to figure how to eat, how to grow food, etc. Then we slowly went into the Pranamaya, and science is now beginning to kind of feel what is Pranamaya kosha. Okay, and then comes Manomaya kosha. And right. Then is Vijnana, and then finally is Anandamaya kosha.
And the ultimate is actually beyond these koshas.
Yeah. So we are where we are. We are kind of setting the stage, you know, for where we are still grappling as human beings.
It takes me back to another beautiful discourse which Swami speaks of. I mean, in that, Swami is talking about all these sages and saints, and I think 91 Samukos. Swami says there are sages who have achieved this, who have, you know, complete control over their mind, and all of this Swami says. Then immediately Swami says, but don't get discouraged, right? Because they were as human as you are. They did not come from anywhere. They were born with the same intelligence. So when you look at them, don't get so awestruck that you don't try taking on the journey that they did. You can achieve it because, you know, who else can say it than the Creator Himself? He's saying the same stuff which I gave them, I've given it to you. So don't complain or don't, you know, wilt from taking the path.
And as you said, Swami always has given so much importance to the mind, whether in the negative sense or in the positive sense. On one hand, yeah, as we discussed, Swami calls it the drunken mad monkey bitten by a scorpion. On the other hand, Swami says Manuja. Manuja is the term which is used to refer to man. And so the term Manuja means born of the mind. Swami says man today is because he owes his existence to the mind. Otherwise, man is not man without the mind. So is the, the interpretation of the terms Manushya or Manava. All of them are related to the mind. The same Swami who has condemned the mind in that manner has also said, Mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo. The mind is responsible for the bondage of man or liberation of man. And when you hear that, it becomes amply clear that the mind is like a tool. It is like a knife. In the hands of a murderer, it is the most ghastly thing. In the hands of a surgeon, it is the most redeeming and uplifting thing. So the mind as such is neither good nor bad. And I feel whenever Swami praises the mind or criticizes the mind, it is actually praise or criticism to the way the mind is used. So mind as such is neutral. And that, you know, that adds one more layer of enigma to the mind. Because you know what? Mind is neither bad nor good. Then what is it?
You know, just when you said neutral, we talk about net neutrality today. You know, probably the most fundamental, our inner net that has been given to us is neutral. As Swami would say, turn the mind towards the right and it gets freed.
It's freed. Turn it to the left, you get locked. The mind is the key which, if you turn left towards the world,
is bondage or liberation. So it's
that's the beauty. Now when you say that, it's about how you use the mind. So who uses the mind? You know, you think everything through your mind. You make choices through your mind. You understand everything through your mind. So what should what works when you're trying to understand the mind? What works when you're trying to make a choice with the mind?
It's a kind of a, almost like a paradox, isn't it? That you're trying to understand the mind using the mind.
Absolutely.
How do you understand the mind? You're using the mind only to understand it. Right? It's almost like a circular reference concept in Microsoft Excel.
There is a story which Swami says about the mind in one of the Samukos discourses where Swami says, the mind is like a policeman, right? But who is the mind trying to catch? It's the same mind. It's like a policeman chasing itself because that's what it is. And to add to that, you need witnesses to nail a person who has done a crime. And who is the witness? It's again the mind. Then who is the judge? It's again the mind, right? So it's a very complex story where...
Prem, you see, you brought up a very, very interesting theme here. That is, whenever references are made to the mind, when Arjuna said, O chanchalam hi mana Krishna, ప్రమాతి బలవద్రుడం తస్యాహం నిగ్రహం అన్యే వాయోరివ సుదుష్కరం. ఓ కృష్ణ, మై మైండ్ ఇస్ మోర్ వేవరింగ్ దెన్ ద విండ్ ఇట్ సెల్ఫ్. ఐ మీన్ ఐ ఫైండ్ ఇట్ ఈజియర్ టు స్టాప్ ద విండ్ రాదర్ దెన్ స్టాప్ మై మైండ్. ద వేవరింగ్ నేచర్ ఆఫ్ మైండ్, హౌ డు ఐ కంట్రోల్ ఇట్ వర్సెస్ when Swami gives an analogy of a mind being like a fly that goes and sits on garbage and sits on prasadam as well. So you find many, many references to the mind, not only in the scriptures, not only in discourses, across religions, across different thinkers. And like the example that you gave, mind is the policeman, mind is the judge, mind is everything. So I think it will be a very, very important thing for us to actually understand what is this mind that we are talking about. And what are possibly its different functions, because what we will understand is that the different functions of the mind is possibly denoting the mind in different examples. Like we say, God is the creator, Brahma is the creator, Vishnu is the preserver, Shiva is the destroyer. So what does actually God do? Does he create? But he is destroying also. He is preserving also. Means it's confusing until and unless we realize that God is actually all these three and much more. And these are different functions of God. And the functional aspects of God has given one name. So I think that is what we will arrive at even for the mind. So this discussion is definitely going to be interesting. So don't go away anywhere, listeners. We'll be back. We'll take a little break. And on the other side of the break, we'll try to put our minds to the theme to understand what on earth is this mind.
Oh,
from Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam to Manasa Bhajare about the Manas itself. I think that's what all our minds will be doing right now. Welcome back, dear listeners. As we said before the break, we'll be now trying to, you know, brainstorm possibly and come to a consensus on what possibly is the mind. No, because right away, you know, when I just tell somebody that, you know, I am upset in my mind, my fingers automatically go and point at my temples, possibly referring to my brain or my skull as the home of my mind. So is the mind the brain? Is the mind, I don't know, I really don't know. But when we look at Swami's discourses, Swami says the mind is a bundle of thoughts. He gives the example of a piece of cloth which is made up of multiple threads. And he says that each of those threads is a thought. Every time you pull out the thoughts, as you become thoughtless, you will see that there's no mind at all. So mind is nothing but a universal set of all thoughts together. So going by that, you know, I just feel mind is a bundle of thoughts. So the summation of all thoughts is the mind.
But, you know, but if I can also then add this argument, many times, no, we do something and somebody comes and says, "Hey, what were you thinking, man, when you were doing?" "I wasn't thinking here. I don't know, it just happened." Right? Then what do you say to that? So, if it is a bundle of thoughts, then your body, right, the body and the mind complex is one. If I wasn't thinking, then who was doing? Okay, and there are several things that I do, just like that. I mean, you know, for example, when I touch a hot pan, instinctively my hand just takes off. So is that, there's no thought over there.
No, scientifically,
right?
That is called a reflex action.
Right.
And the reflex pathway has been studied. Apparently, before you do anything, the messages reach the brain and the brain sends out instruction on what has to be done. But suppose a hot pan touches your hand, so from the hand, the nerves conduct the message to the spinal cord, which conducts it to the brain, and the brain has to give back. Apparently, in this case, the spinal cord itself takes a decision. You know, so it doesn't even go to the brain. That's why it's called a reflex action, where you do the action first and then think about it. So going by that, possibly, yeah, maybe it's not located in the brain. Maybe the brain plus spinal cord, you know, that is the speed of the mind.
So then can we say, I mean, reflex, can it also be called as instinct? Because instinctively, you know, somebody just suddenly, or, you know, we all go on bikes, yeah? And something goes into our eye in absolutely a fraction of a second and our eyelids, you know, we shut down. And I always think, oh my God, what a fantastic, you know, sometimes, of course, the dust does manage to enter the eye and then it irritates the eye for a long time.
Very rarely.
But how fantastic. So, is this instinct? Can we call so that the mind is also instinct?
In fact, that reflex that you were speaking about, I think that is what has inspired even Swami to say that God protects you like the eyelid protects the eye. Means there is no thinking involved. It is so spontaneous.
Spontaneous. So where does spontaneity come from?
I think that's the beauty. You know, if you see a cricket player playing, and that's why I always get fascinated when they play a stroke. And they slow it down and they give it in slow motion and they show it in ultra slow motion, right? And there are so many possibilities when a bowler bowls a ball, right? I mean, it could be a short ball, it could be a length ball, it could be over pitched ball, it could be a swinging ball, it could be an off spin, leg spin, and all of those options. And the batsman has absolutely no time to decide what stroke to play. But most often, the best of batsmen, you know, at least we know our favorites, Sachin Tendulkar or Virat Kohli, they know exactly what is the stroke that has to be played. It's almost like reflex, which suggests that what is a reflex can also be practiced and gained. So what we call a spontaneous reflex act can also be acquired. Now that makes it very difficult to demarcate what is reflex and what is acquired, right?
Yeah. Just when you talked about the cricket analogy, I was in fact reading an interview of Sachin where he's talking to a few children, and you know, they were asking him questions on how he manages to time the ball very well, and he was saying, when you're at the peak of your concentration, when you're at the alpha zone, as he called it, you don't even know whether the bowler is bowling around the wicket or over the wicket. At that stage, it is your subconscious mind which is playing the shot. Okay. So again, he used the word subconscious mind, which is playing the shot. And it probably becomes so much a part. We were talking to Mr. VVS Lakshman a couple of years back in the studio, right? And he was saying that he actually faces the previous night when we were asking him how does he prepare for a test match, especially we were just, India had just returned from a grueling tour of South Africa where you had Morne Morkel and Dale Steyn, some of the best, you know, fast bowlers. And he was saying that, right, in the previous night, he visualizes in the mind what kind of balls they're going to bowl at him, and he plays all of those shots in his mind, and so then that is already then stored. The next morning, he says, I just listen to music, I walk out on the field, and I'm ready to play the shot because I've already played it in the mind the previous night. Right? So probably exactly as you were saying, that reflex or that instinct or impulse can also come through habit.
Right. Not only can you make it a reflex, but going back to, I mean, at the cost of extending the cricket talk, you know, Rahul Dravid has a very beautiful anecdote in this one, that there was a phase in his career when he would probably play one particular stroke. I think he would poke in the offside, you know, when the ball is bowled, as they say, to the fourth stump line or something they call that.
Corridor of uncertainty. Corridor.
And he had this habit of playing that. That was one of his good strokes. He used to play play the cover drive and the back foot cover drive. That if you bowl it there and if your ball is swinging, that he's going to play that stroke and he's going to give a catch to the slip. And there was a series of dismissals by which he was getting out that way. And knowing the dedication of Rahul Dravid, you know, he goes back, he works on it. He works so hard that he played an entire test match. I think he made a century without playing that stroke once. So which means he actually pulled this one back, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
For those of our listeners who are not aware of cricket, because cricket is quite a complicated game, let me take a golf analogy that I read in a Chicken Soup for the Soul series. There was this golfer who was trapped in a concentration camp during the World War II. And after the World War, when he came out, he turned out to be one of the top golfers in the world. Probably not the number one or number two, but definitely within the top 15 or top 20. And people wondered, where on earth did he practice his golf? Because everyone knows that he's a survivor who has gone through Holocaust. He has gone through such a hell in his life. And he said that, I was cooped up in such a small cage. There was nothing to do for days and weeks on the end. But I refused to be in the cage. I closed my eyes and I would be on my turf. I would be in the golf course and I would practice, I would fine tune, I would use different clubs. Imagine all this in imagination, all this in the mind. And it has worked as good as his actual practice. Though his body did not do the practice, he came out and he seemed to have that skill. He seemed to have that skill. So we see a lot of such examples where people visualize and they materialize. In fact, Bhagwan had even given that as one of the techniques to bring God into your life on a day-to-day basis. He had told our teacher, Krithiventi Anil Kumar sir, when he was a student, he had told that only. That when you sing each bhajan, if you are able to close and visualize the feel, everything perfectly. In fact, he told them, you sing Gopala. What is the meaning of Gopala? He said, you know, go means a cow. You know, a cow that is vegetarian all its life, it eats only grass. But when its baby, its calf is born, in order to ensure that the calf can live, it eats non-veg. It eats the placental covering that is around the calf. And that is the kind of sacrifice that the goat does. You don't understand the love of a goat. Where do you understand the love of Gopala? Because if you can feel the love of Gopala, that love will be on you. You know, this is what Swami had said. So this thing about visualizing and materializing, definitely, you know, it takes mind to another level. Because all that our brain has got, you say, is like the collective learning that we have gone through in our life. We learn things and we improve. But the mind seems to be one level more advanced, because you don't even have to actually go through. You can simulate, you can imagine and make it happen. I mean, it's fascinating. It brings one more level.
Yeah, so it's almost like saying that, you know, we started with the most rudimentary understanding, which is mind is a bundle of thoughts, but it's not just thoughts. It could be instincts, it could be impulses, it could be feelings, it could be emotions, you know, and it seems to, so you know, and an all-encompassing entity seems to be where whatever you try to attribute, it seems to describe one function of the mind.
Absolutely. And if you're talking about emotions and feelings, again, that we think is spontaneous, right? If we are in pain, we become sad, if we're in this one. But again, Swami says that you have to control that. You have to go beyond pain and sorrow. So you have the ability to go beyond that too. You know, you have a mind which can have a cap on the emotions too, and that is something which we can't imagine.
Correct.
And that's why, you know, every time I think of this, when we even talk about why is it important to understand the mind for somebody who's probably in the path of devotion, right? Because you're talking about surrender. So if I can give my mind, why should I bother about understanding the mind? It's all about only giving. But that again, you know, I used to think if Swami comes up to us when we're sitting in the mandir and Swami says, why are you sitting here? Go and sit on the other side of the pathway, or go and sit near the garage. It's very easy for us to obey. We just have to get up and go there. But if Swami was to come and tell us, you know, today onwards, don't think more than 5 thoughts a day. How much ever I would love to obey Swami, I can't obey Swami because that's all control I have over myself. I have control over my hands and my legs, but I don't have control over my thoughts. So that is a completely different level. And, you know, there's a beautiful analogy from the life of Ramana Maharishi,
okay,
right? Where Ramana Maharishi is supposed to be in silence, you know, for a long periods of time. And there's a person who comes up to Ramana's ashram. And he says, he's a mind reader. He can just look at you, you can think of anything and he'll tell you what you're thinking of. He's an expert at that. So he says, I can read people's mind. So he says, I will read Ramana Maharshi's silence. He says, when he's silent, what is he really thinking of? So he goes and Ramana Maharshi smiles and he says, yeah, you can sit here. And he sits in front of him and that man sits for 3 hours staring at Ramana Maharshi, and Ramana Maharshi is sitting and smiling and looking at him. At the end of it, he gets up and falls at Ramana Maharshi's feet and he says, for 3 hours, I couldn't sense one thought passing across his mind. He says, so when you say mind is a bundle of thoughts, you can even maintain a mind without a single thought passing through that. So how do you define mind as a bundle of thoughts? The mind is still there. I mean, it's a completely different puzzle thrown into this idea of the mind, right?
True. <Yeah. laughs>
And when we speak of all this, again, as Brother Amai reminded in the beginning, this is all in the wakeful state. How do you explain when I go to sleep, my brain is in switch off mode? Definitely, because you know, those little sounds, the donkey braying, you know, many times I give the example of donkey braying because we have 3 donkeys near our home that bray, and Brother Amai will agree to that. They bray throughout, they have no time, sense of timing, nothing. And this donkey braying disturbs me when I'm trying to go to sleep. But when I'm sleeping, the donkey braying doesn't disturb. My ears are there. It just means that I hear and yet I don't hear. Like how Swami would say, Pashyannapi na pashyati mudo. You see and yet you do not see, you fool. That's because I'm switched off. I hear and yet I do not hear. I possibly see because possibly in my dream state, you know, many times my wife tells that, you know, when I switched on the light, you actually got disturbed, I'm sorry. I have no recollection of that. She said, no, you got up, you looked at me, you turned and slept. I saw and yet I did not see. I have got that experience of Pashyannapi na pashyati mudo. So in our sleep, this happens, which means our physical system, our brain and nervous system, they're all possibly switched off. And yet, many times I wake up from sleep feeling like I didn't have sleep at all. Because you know what, in my sleep, I'm running away from a tiger, or I'm running somewhere, I'm stuck in the mud. Different kinds of dreams I get, and if I happen to wake up from the dream, I really feel like I have been doing a lot of physical exertion throughout the night. It is as real as my real life running. Or so
exactly, we've experienced several times tears actually coming for an experience that I'm having in the dream. I'm crying or I'm perspiring, right? Or we actually get this this shake as if we have fallen off. I often, many times I used to get this of falling off, you know, the middle or the top berth of in a train, you know, that I'm falling off there, and then I actually get up thinking that I've fallen off, but I have not.
And the interesting thing is, I'm just asking you, have you ever fallen off a train berth?
Yes, once.
But for me, I'm chased by a tiger and a lion, one of my most recurrent dream themes. I don't know. In real life, I'm not scared of a tiger or a lion. I've not had any bad experience of being chased by any animal. I don't know why it happens. So this is what I'm saying, that there is something much, much more phenomenal than the dream state.
Yeah, and strangely, I don't know what is your experience. Do you recollect too many colors in your dream? or are your dreams more monochromatic, or you know, kind of do they have only, for example, many times we've had people saying Swami was wearing a yellow robe, Swami was wearing a red robe. So yeah, we do remember, we do recollect, but if you actually see, the general theme of a dream will be pretty monochromatic. You won't remember too many colors, right? So which is our inability of our mind maybe to project those many colors, you know, in our dream world. Do you actually see yourself in a dream? Many times, you know, you say, we have heard, right, that I was going over here. So, you were going, meaning, were you seeing it through the eyes?
It was the third person or first person.
Third person or first person, right? These are some examples. They were talking about Dale, one great philosopher, Dale Carnegie. Mm-hmm. He was actually talking about, he's worked with a lot of sportsmen. He wanted to know what is the power the mind has over a sportsman. And we have seen, we were just discussing about sportsmen some time back with cricket and golf, right? What he did was, he did a very interesting study. He said that he brought some of the best runners and he put sensors all over their body. And he recreated the entire Olympic Stadium effect with the crowd.
He simulated it.
Yeah, he just simulated it. And then, you know, with that person saying, "On your marks, get set," and the gun goes. And he actually found that all the muscles, the exact set of muscles that are activated when a runner starts running, were actually activated by just
visualizing
that entire process.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen this, that in a dream world, it is actually activating our real body, muscles and, you know, tear glands and all of
sweat,
that.
Sweat.
Exactly. And that feeling that when you were talking, the fatigue. I was not moving a limb and yet I'm feeling fatigued. Right? So this probably gives an additional dimension to mind and how much mind controls the body.
When they say mind over matter, I think this is the negative aspect of mind over matter. The positive aspect is, even though my body is fatigued, I can egg it on and go ahead because it's mind over matter. But here, my body is totally relaxed. Simply because my mind decided that I must be tired, I wake up feeling that I didn't have a proper sleep. I'm feeling so tired because I was... You know,
it's almost like, you know, if I can compare it to, the hibernation mode in the laptop, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have several windows opened,
mm-hmm.
right? So I have Word and Excel and all. And then I just shut down the laptop. And then when I turn it back on, all the applications are still on. Right? So when I wake up, strangely enough, I still know I am Amey Deshpande, I still know I am so and so, all my labels which had been forgotten in my hibernation mode, that I was an Indian, I am a resident of Puttaparthi, etc., all of a sudden it gets activated the moment somebody calls me, even in a deep sleep state, somebody says, "Hey Ameya," and I respond. Which means there is something on, there are some set of systems on, even while...
Background processes.
Background processes are still on, when I'm in deep sleep also. Right? So...
when you said that, you know, I just recollect Bhagwan telling this in the discourse, and I'm sure many have spoken about this also, that there are those nights, of course, it's not that every night we are dreaming and disturbed. There are those nights when we really sleep peacefully. And you know, Swami would ask, you get up in the morning and you say, "I had a very nice sleep." So now who was it? If I didn't even have a disturbed sleep, I can possibly say that the mind is, creating all these simulations and visualizations. And one more fascinating aspect is that it's not that everything that I simulate in my dream is what I have seen in my waking state. Absolute strangers.
I break all laws of physics.
Yes.
I'm able to walk upside down.
and you see absolute new sights. You know, people may say that you have seen this kind of a scene in a Matrix. You know, in the movie Matrix, people walking in the sky, so you're walking. But I see new faces. And talking about movies and Matrix, what about a dream in a dream? I'm telling a real experience, you know. I used to have this great desire that I want Swami to give me a ring. So very often my Bhagwan dream themes would be Swami giving me a ring. And I somehow had this feeling that, this wrong feeling that, If I think of Swami more, Swami will come in my dream. In a way it is true, but not in the way I am thinking. It's not that because I am thinking of Him, I am influencing and coming, getting Him in my dream. It is definitely true that when you think of Swami more, you love Swami more, and there is a greater chance that Swami will come in your dream. But it's not like I am imprinting and creating the dream myself. But because I used to get these ring dreams, I used to think that possibly I am only influencing it because I want a ring. Then imagine I have a dream. I don't know how to tell it. It's so realistic. And in the dream, Swami gives me a ring. And then you know, I said, no, this is a dream. This is a dream, you know. And you know, I woke up. I woke up and can you believe the miracle? There is this ring on my hand. This is possibly the most phenomenal miracle in my life, where you wake up from sleep and you have a ring. I'm thrilled. I ran out. I told my mother. I said, all this time this has happened and finally Swami has given a ring and it's a real ring. Okay? And I got out of the house. I wanted to rush and tell my uncles and others who were there. And can you believe it? Even as I'm narrating this to my uncle, I wake up. You know? And then I realized that it was too much. You know, at that moment, it was too much to comprehend because it seemed so realistic. I don't know how to tell it, Prem or Amay, because I really felt that this time a dream has come true. Where Swami gave me a ring in the dream and I've woken up. So then it's not just a dream. It's a dream in a dream. That's another complication. I mean, what is active then? But what I was speaking before is, when I wake up and say I had a dreamless sleep, I had an awesome sleep, who was there to enjoy that dreamless sleep? I mean, so these are questions that, you know, widen the scope of what the mind is, what are its functions. It's truly mind-boggling.
The beauty is, you know, all of these questions, when we go on repeating it, it's really fascinating that these are questions which have been asked so many times. And most of it has actually been comprehensively answered. If we go back to the Vedanta, you know, all of these questions. But again, we spoke about sportsmen, we spoke about dreams. I mean, talking about dreams, one of the greatest discoveries were made actually in a dream. You know, we've studied chemistry. Kekulé comes up with the structure of benzene. But you know, the question is, here is somebody who has been breaking his head to find out the structure of benzene. The story, the legend is he sleeps and he dreams of a snake biting its own tail, and that's how he says, okay, it's a cyclic structure. But you know, is it that all of the study which he was doing in the waking state which came in his mind, or was it a complete inspiration which was, you know, Providence putting that thought in his head? You never know. Because the moment you talk about Swami and dreams, it's a different world altogether. Like somebody was telling this beautiful incident. Ravikma sir was sharing this incident. You know, it happened, I think, sometime in the 70s when Swami was in Vrindavan. And Swami, you know, Swami would many times leave suddenly to Bhakti and come back. And Swami's plans used to be so very erratic in that sense. So there was this rumor that Swami was leaving one particular weekend, right? From Vrindavan, Swami is going back to Bhakti. So there is this particular person who used to come and do Sevadal duty in Vrindavan. So the news had spread that Swami is leaving that weekend. So this Sevadal has a dream one morning, early in the morning, in which Swami comes and tells him, hey, you know what, I've changed my plans, I'm leaving right now, this morning I'm leaving to Bhakti. You come to Vrindavan because I want to give you an instruction, right? So this is the dream he has. So this person wakes up and he asks everybody, he says, nobody has any clue, Swami is leaving only in the weekend. So he says, nevertheless, let's go to Vrindavan. So he takes his vehicle, I think a scooter or something, and drives to Vrindavan. And when he reaches Vrindavan, what does he see? Things are ready for Swami to leave, right? So Swami is about to leave, and Swami looks at him and calls him and says, you have come. So this is the instruction I wanted to give. Almost like a continuation of that dream which he had. And the way Swami gave him that instruction was very casual. It's like, I told you yesterday to come tomorrow morning, and I've told you what I had to tell you this morning.
It's not like a surprise, like, you came, I was just wondering how to tell you.
Or it is not even like, you know, see, I told you to come in your dream,
Not even that, I came and told you in your dream, nothing like that.
Yeah, because there's no distinction between.
Right. So in that sense, Swami was telling that he can so effortlessly tell you what he wants to tell you in your waking state as much as he can tell it to you in the dream state. So the level of control that Swami has in your dream state is, you know, It kind of blurs that distinction that we have between the waking state and dream state.
Now, when you were speaking about this incident, on the face of it, it appears like the dream world is also the real world. That's what we feel. But what Swami would say is the real world is also a dream world, you know. Correct. In fact, this statement reminds me of what I was reading yesterday about this philosopher called Descartes. He has given a very famous statement which goes as cogito ergo sum, which means I think, therefore I am. So it's very interesting, as well as it can be confusing. I'll tell the interesting part. He says that, you know, when I look back at my own life, I can't take any belief to be true, because I have seen my beliefs changing, my beliefs evolving. Till now you believe that the earth is the center of the universe, then you see that no, the sun is the center of the universe. So he says, I can't assume anything to be true. Everything is false, everything is wrong, everything is an illusion. That's what he says. He says everything is illusion. But then he says, but there is this thought that everything is illusion. And he also says everything is illusion because whatever I'm actually seeing as real, I'm able to create it even when I'm sleeping. So if I say that the whatever is in my sleep is unreal, then this is also as unreal as that. You know, this is his line of argument, his line of thinking. And he says, everything I see therefore is unreal. But he says, in order for this statement to be true, that everything is unreal, that means this statement at least has to be real, you know. This thought has to be real. He says, therefore, since there is a thought, there has to be a thinker. And so he says, therefore, anything that thinks exists. And therefore, he came up with this statement saying, cogito ergo sum, which goes as, I think, therefore I am. Because I am thinking, I can say I exist. You know, but later on, it's very interesting. It's a very detailed subject and I broke my head for about 4 hours on it. And I'm just telling whatever little I understood. But there are many people who have criticized his conclusions. They say that whatever your thought is awesome, but from that you can only say that the thought exists. Just because the thought exists, you can't say that there is a thinker. You can't say that there is a thought, therefore there is a thinker. And apparently that is true. That is the reason why the statement that devotees often make, that there is a creation, therefore there has to be a creator, doesn't hold water in actual logic and philosophy terms. Because you can't say that there is a thought. Yes, there is a thought means there is a thought. Therefore, you know, the later on, many people have come out with the statement, which is slightly modification of this cogito ergo sum. Instead of saying, I think, therefore I am, they say the statement should be, I am. Therefore I think. The moment you say, I am, it also means, it means two things. One is your existence. Second thing, it also means your cognizance of your existence. And the moment you're cognizing, it means you're thinking. So they say that I think, therefore I am is not so logical. What is perfectly logical is I am, therefore I think. Now, possibly our...
I think at the end of that, I should say I'm confused, therefore I am.
Guess what, I forgot the name, but this cogito ergo sum was presented by another person who worked on the work of Descartes and came out with a more comprehensive statement. I forget the Latin of it, but its English translation is, I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am. And they say, this is more comprehensive than I think, therefore I am. So, you know what, Prem, you arrived at this statement all by yourself.
That's the beauty, you know, when you're talking about this confusion of existence and thought, you know, which comes before.
The hen and the egg.
Whether existence itself is a thought, as a thought is the result of existence. I think that's precisely the debate it was about. But that's what, you know, when you talk about the dream state, because even in the dream state, you're thinking, as you were saying, the dream is all about, you know, you're thinking of something in your dream, right? I would always be fascinated, you know, all our dreams, which at least which we remember very clearly are dreams which are related to Swami. I would many times see that my response in my dream would be pretty much what I would like to tell Swami in the real, this one. That, you know, sometimes when Swami comes and asks you, what do you want to say? There will be a lot of things which stops us from telling what we want to tell, the circumstances. Sometimes when you walk up to Swami, you suddenly are in so much awe of Swami, you can't tell what you want to tell. But in the dream, you will blurt out everything that you want to tell. The anger will come out, the disappointment will come out, that you would see that, you know...
Transparency.
Right, that thinking is happening in the dream. And that is another philosophy which they talk about. You know, when they say in Bhagavatam, they say, Kalalo Vaishnava Mayamo. I think in one of
Kalayo
the...
Kalayo Vaishnava Mayamo.
It says, is this a dream which I am living? Or am I living the dream of another person? Am I living the dream of the Lord? Because they, you know, they have this imagery of Lord Vishnu lying down on the Sesha Naga. They say that Vishnu is dreaming the entire creation. So you're all living the dream of the Lord, right? That's another concept which they say that it's
in fact, I remember when you said that, you know, somebody had asked Bhagavan once, I think it's a very well-known story that, Swami, you say that this entire world is illusion, right? Now you have come into this illusion, which does it also means that you are an illusion?
Hislop asked this question to Swami.
Does it mean that God, who has come into this creation, is also an illusion, which means an avatar is an illusion? So then Swami said, very beautifully, he says, when a lion comes and roars in your dream, you wake up. Right? You wake up out of that
fear or
the
awe.
Fear, yes. He says, I am like that lion who has come to wake you up from the dream. So yes, I have come into your dream. And in that sense, I am also a figment of your imagination, but I have to come into your imagination as a figment in order to wake you up to your ultimate reality. And the reality is that I and you are one. And also when you talked about this concept of existence, this is a huge philosophical debate. And in fact, I listen to a lot of these philosophical talks. And, you know, for example, one of the speakers was very beautifully mentioning, there was a whole conference on a pot, it seems, was brought, an earthen pot was brought and kept on our table. Okay, and the whole debate was on, is the pot there? The existence of the pot. Okay. So, you know, the whole discussion was, what is existence? So, you know, for example, it's made up of atoms and therefore it actually is not there because electrons could be in anywhere according to quantum, etc. All of that was being discussed. So the speaker very beautifully said, there used to be a watchman, it seems, who was standing outside and he used to wonder, what are these people discussing about this pot every day? So one day as the speaker walked out, he said, sir, ye kya andar ho raha hai? What is going on, sir? If you want a pot, I'll bring it, sir. If you don't like this pot, I'll get another pot. You know? And this person was like, no, you have no idea. We are discussing about, you know, whether the pot exists or not, you know. So existence itself is a very fascinating thing. And therefore, I think when Swami or when Taittiriya Upanishad said, you know, Eko Ham Bahusyam, right? Where he
the
says...
The one became many.
Yeah, the one became many. And or when Swami says, I separated myself from myself to love myself. And we know this. Which means there was the existence, which is Shiva was there, you know, whichever name you want to call it. And the moment Shakti, or when you say the first thought, which in Lalita Sahasranam is called as Vimarsha, why is this entire universe come? Why did it choose to come 14 billion years back? Was there no God before that? Yeah, existence was always there. The moment this thought came, the first thought which embedded itself in Shiva, and that is from which this entire Prakriti or Shakti came. And they call that first thought which made Shiva into a living person. Till then he was a Shava. Okay, so the moment Shakti entered, Shiva became Shiva. And this whole, you know, this whole projection started. Okay, so therefore, existence always precedes thought. Okay, according to Vedanta. Okay, and that is why the Lord in Taittiriya Upanishad, how does Taittiriya Upanishad define God? Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam, Brahma. Okay, and this is probably the most comprehensive definition of God. Truth. And truth is that which always exists, as Bhagavan says, Rutam. Right? It can never change. It's the unchanged, the changeless, right? So Satyam, Jnanam. It is not just the truth with existence, but it is also all wisdom. So all wisdom was there. And then it is infinite. So probably I would say that in a sense, Vedanta gives this answer that existence was first there and everything else comes out of that existence.
So it's our journey will possibly be from, I think, therefore I am, because that's where Yad Bhavam Tad Bhavati comes, you know, what I think I become, to I am, therefore I think. You know, possibly that will be the journey. It also makes sense this way because, you know, many times we have heard Bhagavan say that the Atma is the grandfather, the mind is the father, and Vak is the child, you know. So it is like the mind, which is supposed to be a bundle of thoughts in one of the definitions, has its origin in Atma, which is nothing but existence. So even in that sense, you know, intuitively you feel that the ultimate truth must be I am, therefore I think, rather than I think, therefore I am.
I mean, absolutely. I think the concept of which is, how did that creation happen, and talking about dream state, waking state, I mean, as you're saying, the Upanishads speak of it in various levels, and it's amazing how they speak about the manifest divinity and the unmanifest. In fact, there's that beautiful Kavali, which is in one of the Hindi films, Kun Faya Kun. Actually, Kun Faya Kun itself is a concept which comes in Quran, which is very beautiful. It says, God thought, so everything came to be. You know, that's the meaning of it. And there is that wonderful line in that Kavali where it says, you were there before even nothing was there. Mm. It is not that you were there before everything was there. You were there even before nothing was there.
Jab yahan kuch nahi tha, yeah, to wahi tha, but he was there.
Because the concept of nothing itself comes when there is a concept of everything and something. Right? He says, even before the concept of nothing came, you were there. And in fact, that is what is, I think the Vedas describe that state as the avyakrita state, and which is actually beyond the avyakrita state, which is similar to what we call as the turiya state, which they say deep sleep is one state, but a state sushupti beyond that, sushupti, or the turiya state, which you cannot understand in your waking state, so don't try.
Yeah. No, actually, when I was hearing about, maybe we are going into another area, but turiya, you know what is the meaning of turiya?
Mm-hmm. I know turiya, because you had told me the other day.
Yeah. Turiya simply means the fourth stage.
Right, exactly.
Okay, it does not have any other great significance. Turiya simply means the fourth.
So the first state is the waking state. Mm. The second state is the
dream state.
The third is the deep sleep state where you are dreamless. The turiya is none of these, none of the above.
Yeah, but that, because of which you have the first three stages. That which exists in and through the three states is what is the turiya state. And which is what Swami says, idi nijama, adi nijama. Idi kuda nijam ledu, adi kuda nijam ledu. So what you know, in that 1974, that YouTube video which is there, which is the crux of, you remember that beautiful interview that Swami is giving
to all the Westerners.
He says, are you in Prashanti Nilayam? But when you sleep at night, you go to California. So now, are you in California or are you in Prashanti Nilayam? You are neither in California or in Prashanti Nilayam, but what you are, that is what is your reality. The one who is in California, the one who is in Prashanti Nilayam, that entity is who you are. Yeah.
I think before I forget, both the two Janaka episodes that I remembered, once when Prem was speaking, once when you were speaking. Yeah, Amai, when you were speaking, the Janaka episode I remembered is when he gets up from a nightmare and he wonders whether what he saw in the nightmare is true or the pleasures that he's enjoying in the kingdom that is true. So the story goes that whomever he meets, he just asks, is that true or is this true? Is that true or is this true? And everybody thinks that the king has gone mad. He's gone bonkers.
Not only mad, they say that the entire affairs of the kingdom stopped.
Come to a standstill.
Because every paper that would go to him, you know, for his policy decision, he would say, is this true or is,
or is that true? That is when I think Yajnavalka, right?
It was Ashtavakra.
Ashtavakra. He comes to him and he says, neither is this true nor that true, but the one who witnessed both, he is true. Actually, and with that...
Just a correction, it's Vasishta actually.
Okay.
No, it is Yad.
Swami says it is Vasishta.
Okay.
I mean, it's very interesting because Vasishta seems to be the most...
omnipresent among the sages.
Yeah, I mean, you don't think of Vasishta in that place, but apparently I think...
He's there in the Ramayana, he's...
I think one of our listeners had pointed out to us that actually it is Vasishta who tells, clarifies this doubt to Janaka. Yeah,
okay. It is after that the policy paralysis stops and the kingdom proceeds. That is the story when you were talking, Amai. And Prem, when you were saying about, you know, how when Swami comes and tells, can you give me your mind? We just can't, can you think only three things? We cannot. That is what Janaka achieves. Because he asks, can somebody give me the ultimate? And again, I don't want to hazard against that sage's name. But that sage tells me, I will give you that, but you have to give me your mind. And he says, I offer you my mind. And he offers his mind. And he's simply seated there like a motionless like a rock. When suddenly there's a fire in the kingdom and they come and tell the fire is there. It's burning down the royal palace. Your wives are in danger. All that. And King Janaka doesn't move a bit. And he later on, he just states it helplessly saying, how could I respond because my mind is not with me? It's amazing because how much ever I may think that I'm giving my mind and thoughts to God. If somebody comes now, I'm just imagining if I'm lost and I say, Swami, this half an hour is for you. I'm sitting. Swami is physically sitting there and I'm doing Pad Seva. If someone were to come and tell, your car, you know, is on fire and you definitely need to come there. I would have told Swami, my car, please do something. You know, you need to have absolute mastery over the mind in order to be able to offer the mind, in order to surrender the mind. That is possibly the reason why Swami, when I got up and told Swami, you please take the mind, he didn't accept it, because Swami says, yes, I have told Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam, but in order for you to offer your mind to me, the mind must belong to you. You have to master the mind. Your mind can't be your master. A slave can't offer the master to somebody. A master can offer the slave to somebody. Enslave your mind, then offer it to me, and I will take care of the rest.
Absolutely. I think there's so much to talk about the mind in that sense. But I mean, to understand, to put it in such a way that Swami finally says all of this can be done just by doing bhajans and namasmarana, it gives you a perspective of how powerful a tool that is. After speaking of what the mind is, if Swami says nothing, just do japam, just do namasmarana, you can achieve so much more.
That was what in the previous segment Brother Raghu was highlighting about. Exactly. That pole and the demon, the mind to do namasmarana.
Absolutely. And the technique for handling the complicated mind is pretty simple. The only thing is the practice is lacking in many, many ways, right? That's what actually misses out.
If I can use the if I can use the analogy of very quickly, so to kind of sum up, if you can use a very simplistic analogy that if the body were to be the hardware, we can probably say that the mind seems to be the operating system, you know. So whatever applications and then the viruses and then the malware and all of that also comes, and then you can use the mind, and then you can also hibernate the mind and the applications keep running. Okay, and then probably what Swami always would often say is that Atma is nothing but the electricity. If you are able to keep our mind, you know, with having a strong defender, just like Windows Defender or has a very strong antivirus, okay, which can stop things from coming in, or probably have an operating system which does not even
allow
this virus to come in, right? So that would be the ideal state that we should be reaching. And of course, to know that what actually powers this entire thing is that nothing but that electricity.
Yeah, the beautiful thing about this analogy, I feel, is that it makes it clear that all that you see on the screen is nothing but one form of, positively speaking, interpretation, negatively speaking, distortion of that same electric current. The same electric current is interpreted as a light, is interpreted as air in the fan, is interpreted as visuals on a screen. So the most important is electricity. I think that's a beautiful analogy. But when we, you know, go back to our scriptures, as Prem said, there's a beautiful way in which the mind has been divided into different parts based on the functions. And I think possibly we can take a quick break, come back after the break and introduce these four parts to our listeners, and then take it on possibly ahead in the next satsang.
एक तुम ही हो बन बंधु सखारे
I think even as we were playing that song, we realized it's much better to leave with that song rather than, you know, leave with our more confusing thoughts. But even as we were listening to that song, you know, I was thinking, I was just telling Amai, now in this song they say Man Mandir Mein, which means mind is not just a bundle of thoughts, but it's actually even the temple. So it adds more confusion. But going back to what you were telling about the different names which are given in the scriptures for the mind, we'll take it up next time, certainly. But there's one thing which Swami tells about this nomenclature itself. Mm. Swami would say that, a Brahmin, we usually call that, it's one of the castes in the Indian tradition. Swami said, you know, he's a Brahmin, Brahmin is a caste, but the Brahmin who cooks is called a Vanta Brahmin. The Brahmin who chants mantras in a marriage is called a certain name. The Brahmin who chants mantras in a death ceremony is called a different name. So Swami would say that the caste is the same, but depending on the function which is performed, he is given a different name. And Swami says, same is the case with the mind. Depending on what role the mind plays, it's not a different mind for each of these functions, but depending on what role it plays, it is given a name.
Probably a bit like, you know, the device we have in our hands, which is a smartphone. The same phone becomes a camera. The same phone becomes
a music player.
A music player. The same phone becomes a reminder,
our calendar, system,
exactly,
timekeeper.
So probably the smartest ever device given to us was this mind, and so therefore the different functions.
Yeah. So I just want to add on to what Prem said. When we say the mind has these parts, it's unlike the brain, where you say the frontal brain, the cerebral cortex, the midbrain, the hindbrain, it's not positional, it's not broken, it's not divided. In fact, as Brother Amai, you were saying, the brain itself is today considered as a holographic brain. It's not like located. Nobody is able to actually say that sights are stored here or audio signals are stored there, because as they have experimented with rats and mice, plucking out even parts and cells from one part of the brain doesn't erase that memory. It seems to have got transferred to some other part of the brain. So though the brain we have segmented for our study, it itself is holographic. So mind, definitely it's not like we are breaking up and telling this is a part. The mind is just one entity, but we will be describing the different functions of the mind, just as we describe the functions of God as creator, organizer and destroyer. And we have Brahma, Vishnu and Mahesh, though they are actually the same thing.
And, you know, when I was in school, I always used to have this literally like a nightmare. You know, when you spend so much time studying, especially the subjects which are difficult to get into your head, I always used to think, you know, after all this study, one day you're going to die and all of this is going to go. You have to redo the whole thing, right? You know, that used to be very scary. But Swami says that there are some thoughts which actually travel with you, which means there is, mind is a continuum. It's not, I mean, as you're talking about mind and brain being the same and that confusion there, Swami talks of mind being a continuum, and there are only few things which can carry on. I think 2 days back we sent out that message in Science Fairs where Swami says, the love for God that you develop is something that you carry forward from one birth to the other. So there are some things which are worth carrying along, and some things, as we, I think in one of the satsangs we said, some things will be stopped at the customs. It's not worth buying those things when you're shopping abroad, right?
Very, very important. This will be in the next satsang, dear listeners, because it will also give us focus in our life as to what we should spend our time and energies trying to gather. Because if there is some part of the mind alone that gets transferred to the next birth, should we not work on those, invest in those kind of thoughts or building up those investments rather than things that we'll have to leave behind and go.
True.
So,
should we introduce?
Yeah, I think so. I might just introduce.
So, I think a bit of everything that we said gets categorized in what Swami says as the four functions of the brain.
Which
is manas, buddhi. So, these are the Sanskrit terms for that, and we will try and explain as best as possible what are the English terminology. Manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara.
Before concluding, dear listeners, we'll just translate it into English. Though there is no perfect translation possible, manas can possibly be translated as the working mind, like the RAM of a computer, which is useful for day-to-day activities like brushing or whatever we do. Buddhi is the discriminating function of the mind, which discriminates between good and bad, whatever. And chitta is like the ROM of a computer which stores everything. It is the fund of reservoir of all the memories, everything, not only in this birth but across births. And Ahankara is finally the identity. The identity that mind gives for itself, whether it identifies as the body. Swami often says that when you identify as the body, you are an animal. When you identify as the mind, you are a devil. When you identify as the Atma, you are your true self, what you're supposed to be. But all of these we will go into much greater detail in our next satsang. We will focus on these four aspects, four functional divisions of the mind, that is Manas, Buddhi, Chitta, Ahankara. We hope that you have enjoyed the confusion and the resolution of the confusion as much as we have enjoyed. As always, you can write to us with your thoughts, because the satsang is about thoughts. Possibly we will run it for several more sessions. You can write to us with your thoughts, your feedback, your experiences, anything under the sun where it concerns the mind. You can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We will continue with the same theme the next week also, with possibly the same trio over here. So till then, have a lovely week ahead. Enjoy. Think of Swami. Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam. Let us offer our thoughts, feelings and love at His lotus feet and pray that He guides every moment of our lives. With gratitude, we end with a song that Prem faded a little earlier, saying that it would be a nice ending. So we will play that beautiful song once again for you to enjoy. That it's a bhajan actually from Bhavanjali series. You can enjoy that bhajan. On the other side of it, you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
या मोरी पार करो रखवारे भव सागर में नैया मोरी पार करो रखवारे मन मंदिर में आओ प्यारे आओ हमारे मन मंदिर में आओ प्यारे आओ साई हमारे एक तुम ही हो बंधु सखारे
एक तुम ही हो बंधु सखारे
आओ साई मन की वीणा तुझे पुकारे आओ साई हमारे
मन की वीणा तुझे पुकारे आओ साई हमारे
भव सागर में नैया मोरी पार करो रखवारे
भव सागर में नैया मोरी पार करो रखवारे
भव सागर में नैया मोरी पार करो रखवारे मंदिर में आओ प्यारे आओ साई हमारे